MEC, the voice of business.
I'm Scott Waller, President and CEO of the Mississippi Economic Council. Welcome to the Voice of Business podcast. Today, we have a very special podcast. It's an interview with Governor Phil Bryant, First Lady Deborah Bryant, that was recorded at Hobnob, Mississippi on October 31st. It was a chance to sit down and talk to them about their life in public service.
Now, this is kind of fun. I don't think I've ever had a chance just to sit down and talk to the two of y'all in a setting like this and kind of talk about
it. It's an intimate conversation.
Yeah, only 1,500 of our closest friends, you know, exactly. So, you know, Governor, you have spent a lot of time in public service. You started as deputy sheriff, served in the House, then became state auditor, served as lieutenant governor, and over the last 8 years have served as our governor. And over that time frame, without question, there's been a lot of things that you focused on, but one in particular, job creation, has kind of been at the core of everything you focused on. And for us to be successful in that arena, there's one thing that we have to do, and that is focus on workforce development. Earlier today, I mentioned to our crowd here that on the tables was a copy of the Mississippi Works magazine that just was published just a couple of weeks ago, that highlights some of the key careers and opportunities for our citizens across the state, and particularly our young students that are looking for something to do. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to fruition and really how it plays into your overall plan of growing Mississippi's workforce?
Well, every opportunity we have to get information into the hands of students will be beneficial. Now, think back when you were in eighth grade and most of us thought, well, we're going to be an athlete or a rock star. You know, that was kind of our choices. And I remember asking my son about that time. I said, son, what would you like to be when you grow up? And he said, rich. Okay, I get that. I'm good. Let's figure out how we can help get you there. So the 8th graders, 11th graders, and 12th graders will get a copy of this beautiful magazine. Now, it's just not something to thumb through. They can look at the jobs that they may want, whether it's technical jobs, whether it's building warships, whether it's in energy departments, agribusiness, healthcare, and there will be numbers there that they can call the company. They could call Ingalls, Jim, and say, I want to build warships. I'm in the 8th grade. What do I need to do? And can get directed how to get into a program then and learn how to be a master marine welder. It lists the salaries, so they'll look down and go, okay, that's the job I want because I see what the salary level will be. It will be a teaching opportunity so students can go online and see the social version of this and of course, click on it and hear real stories from real people. This book, this magazine is full. Take a look at it, of real Mississippians. Lex Taylor and I were just talking at the table, and Lex said, you know, that young man is from my hometown in Louisville, and he has started his own business 25 years old. He's an entrepreneur. And so we want our students to understand there are real success stories here in Mississippi. You know, they hear enough negative ideas coming out from different areas, and when they see the success that's going on through this magazine, when they operate on the social platform that made it available for them, when the teacher takes it and uses it in the training for those students so that they will look at this and say, okay, that's what I want to be. I'm in the 8th grade, I'm in the 11th grade, I'm in the 12th grade. How do I get there? So it's a roadmap to success for the hundreds of thousands of children that we need to keep here and keep in our workforce.
You know, and to actually have the type of workforce that's going to be successful, it all begins with a strong education. I know that's been one of your top priorities.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot today, from early this morning throughout the day, about the announcement yesterday with our NAEP scores, particularly our reading. I know that during your tenure working on that, the creation of the third grade reading gate, it's really started to make an impact. And we're going to put a graphic up on the screen.
Have y'all heard about this? Anybody mention we're number one?
The graphic
in the
that's on the screen, it may be hard for some of y'all in the back to see, but that line that's extremely long at the very top, that's Mississippi.
That's us.
And that's what we have done in terms of making gains on this test. And tell us a little bit about what you think that's going to lead to.
When I came in, even as lieutenant governor, trying to to understand the real challenges in public education and what we could do about it, not just use it as a political wedge, a way to divide people. And that's what had happened in the past. Everybody would say, well, you know, Republicans, they really hate children and they don't like school teachers and all of that stuff that you hear. And we said, look, we're going to see if we can't make dramatic changes in results. And so we came up with this idea, the literacy-based program, in 2013. It was a Senate bill. Lieutenant Governor just left here, so he helped shepherd it through the Senate in 2013, a radical idea when we said, you know, you can't be socially promoted to the fourth grade if you can't read on a third grade level. Oh my goodness, the gnashing of teeth. We have copies of some of the editorials that folks said, oh, it's going to destroy their self-esteem. He's going to hold thousands of children back. It's going to destroy the minority community. If what I could tell you about this also, African-American students and Hispanic students in Mississippi outpace the rest of the nation. The rest of the nation among African Americans and Hispanics outpaced them. They did better in Mississippi than anyone else in America. This third grade gate simply said, you've got to learn how to read by that third grade. And so we put reading coaches out there. We put hundreds of millions of dollars over the years into that so these coaches could go out and not teach the students, but teach the teachers. Reading is a science. I'm dyslexic. So once you find out you've got a reading challenge, you've got to figure out what you can do about it. But we believe at that 2013, 7 years ago, now, if you look at what has happened since then, the scores after about the third year dramatically came up. Third graders are reading at an 85.6, I believe, percentage level, higher than ever before on that test because we increased the challenge of the test. But the numbers, if you look at what's being reported in this, and I just had, if I could read one thing real quick. Dr. Carr, who is the commissioner at the Nation's Center of Education Statistics, said this, so that we won't be confused. Because of its gains, Mississippi's reading scores are the highest they have ever been and are now on par with a national public average. This is meaningful progress for Mississippi. So we went from almost the bottom to the top in 7 years. People said it couldn't be done. We understood how to make that change. And I know the Lieutenant Governor said it, but parents, teachers, administrators, and the students met the challenge. And Deborah can tell you about being in those classrooms and seeing the progress.
And I know that literacy and reading has been very important to the First Lady. Ms. Bryan, if you could talk a little bit in 2014, you set out to what you called Read Across Mississippi, go into classrooms. Why was it so important to stress the value of literacy and really how to overcome reading disabilities?
Well, the reason that I did that was I saw our statistics and how low we were on the number of children that could read by the third grade, and it broke my heart. It really did. And I thought, what can I do that, as a First Lady, what can I personally do to make these children realize the importance and make them realize that they are special, because so many children don't realize they have such poor self-esteem. And so it's easy to go and read to all the schools around you, but to go and actually go to a school in every county takes effort. And I wanted them to know that it was worth the sacrifice for me to make that effort to go to every county, to a school in every county, and read to those children, and not only read, but talk to them about the importance of education, that, you know, how important it is to learn by the third grade, because then you learn to read. I mean, you learn to read, and then you read to learn after that, and how important it is in their future that they learn to read. And I would take little things like stop signs, and, you know, you have to be able to drive, you have to be able to read. And so we would talk about all kinds of issues, and the fact that Phil was dyslexic, and the fact that he's been pretty successful to be a dyslexic kid that also struggled, and the struggles that he went through, angry, the same things that you see in children, he went through it. Funny that I never knew Phil was dyslexic till he became governor, but I think it's really awesome too that he felt like he could express an issue that he had and get personal in order to be able to make other kids understand that they too could be successful even though that they have challenges. So that's one reason that I went across the state and loved on those kids and hopefully just made a little bit of difference.
And that being the case, the fact that you were able to travel really to every corner, I'm sure you've got some wonderful memories, but in some cases, it's just being there to talk to the kids. Would you mind sharing maybe a couple of memorable moments that came of that for you?
You know, it's so funny because we'd sit there and we'd talk about what their dreams and aspirations were. Of course, I'm talking to kindergarten through third grade, right? And they all want to be policemen and they all want to be firemen and you know, some want to be mothers. And I said, that's really good, but you just need to wait on that, you know. Let's don't think about the mother, being a mother first, you know. Let's get educated. So we just had the best time talking. One thing that kind of broke my heart and a memory that always sticks with me is one of the first schools that I went to. All the kids are sitting there and always sit in a little chair, so I'm on their level or sit with them on the floor. And we were talking about everybody was saying what they wanted to be, and this little girl sitting in front of me, and she says, I want to be a prisoner. My mom's a prisoner. And, you know, how do you even respond to that? Thankfully, other kids were shouting out what they wanted to be and raising their hand and everything, and I, you know, but that just broke my heart. I wanted kids to see a different part of life. So when we would go, I would talk about Phil and our family. I'd show pictures of our family. I would talk about what our likes and dislikes were, the challenges that we had. We talked about a lot of things. You know, and I want those children to know that there's something else out there. I showed them the governor's mansion, the fact that it's their home and not our home. We're just living there temporarily. And I invited every school that I went to. I am the mansion's nightmare, just so you know. The staff knows if somebody calls, I probably invited them to come to the mansion. So we would, you know, a lot of those schools came. So the first one was a Delta school that, you know, that's really hard for them to make that trip with that many kids. But they came, and we always have Mississippi cookies and punch, and we showed them the entire house. You know, it's just to show them there's a different, that they need to step out. Another thing, if I may say, is I read a very difficult book for them. It was called The Fib, A Wordy Tale, which our own Bill Wilson, who is an artist and an author, wrote. And it had big words like the fib, you know, calumniate, exaggerate, equivocate, all these big words. And I would ask the kids to volunteer to come up and read out of that dictionary after the I read to them. And the kids, a few would come up. And what I would have them do, some of us had to kind of hide behind the book and do phonics. And some of them would get up there, but they would get up there and they would try. And then I would have the entire class clap for them because I wanted them to see it was worth trying. And then once they did that and the whole class clapped for them and cheered them, others wanted to get up as well. And so that was just kind of my experience in going around. And I have to agree with Phil and Tate on the fact that we have amazing teachers. We've got teachers out there that's really trying hard. They just need the support. The reading coaches have helped a lot, and they're very grateful for all of that. But I went to a school yesterday, bankers in the classroom, because I work for a bank now. I'm a banker. And we talked to three classes on banking. And we do that to seniors, and so anyway, I do this all day long, whether I'm first lady or banking or whatever I do. I'm in the classroom as much as I can be.
And I'm sure those were some wonderful experiences, but you also had a little bit of a different experience too, as a result of this. In 2014, when you were in Louisville, is when the tornado came through, and you actually, I guess, had to find safety. But then afterwards, you said, "I'm going to stay here and help." Tell a little bit about.
Well, that was a little bit of a whirlwind, no pun intended. We had actually gone to Smithville the day before on a Sunday to open up their new town hall center. It was their third year anniversary of their tornado, which just devastated that little town. And so my staff, my security, and my chief of staff stayed over so that we could go, and we spoke to seniors the next day and read to that school, and then also went on up to Fulton. Well, the weather started getting bad, and they started closing down the schools, and I thought, well, we don't want to get in the middle of this, so we'll, you know, that's fine, we'll see you another time. And we started for home, headed for home. We were between Starkville and Louisville when Phil called and said, where are you? And I said, well, we just left Starkville, and we're in the middle between Louisville and Starkville. And he says, well, there's tornadoes headed your way, you need to get off the road. Well, we kind of went back and forth, you know, well, do we really need to get off the road, do we not need to get off the road? And what was so funny, we were just having the conversation, because you know how the weather looks when you're having tornadoes everywhere, and we're looking around and we're thinking, okay, do we get in a shallow ditch or a deep ditch? Well, you know, where do we go if we see a tornado coming? So it's just funny that Phil calls and says we need to get off the road. So we ended up in, I believe, the courthouse in Louisville, which is the shelter, and all these people are in the hallway. Just lined up because everybody's coming in as fast as they can. They wanted to put me off in a room by myself, you know, because I was first lady. So they want me to stick me in a room more secure than everybody else in that place. And I said, this isn't happening. And I walk out of that room, and the first thing I see is this lady knelt next to a chair praying. And I thought, oh, this is not good. But I went over to her and I said, you know, it's all going to be good. It's going to be fine. The Lord's with us and we're going to be fine. And I walked on down. I saw a little kid that had muscular dystrophy sitting in his grandmother's lap. And he was, when the air started going off and it started getting hot, he was not doing well. So I took that child and took him outside, and we kind of sat and waited for the next cell to come through. But I saw that tornado go on the outskirts of town. And then we immediately start hearing the hospital got hit, the nursing home was hit, there was a daycare hit, and all of these people knew people that were being affected. In fact, I was standing next to a guy as the tornado was on the outskirts of town, and his son I had met a few minutes or several minutes earlier had left. And I said, where did your son go? And he said, well, he went home. And I said, do you think that's a good idea? You send him out of a shelter to go home during a tornado? And he's going, no, we're watching it, and it's not going that way. We're standing there, and the phone rings, and it's his son screaming. And their home had been hit by a tornado. He left. Clay left. He said, you know, I got to go. And I said, of course you got to go. And we didn't hear from him the next day. We didn't know if he was alive or dead. And he went through his neighborhood. This is just a story you should know. He went through his neighborhood, and being, I think he was part of the Mississippi Wildlife Federation. He might have been part. I can't remember. It's been a long time ago. But he said that his truck got caught on an embankment, and he got out of his truck, started running toward his neighborhood. And he said he could hear the people crying out. And he said, you know, I'm the first one they call. It's only right that I should be there when this happened to pull them out. And luckily, his family were fine. They were their house was damaged, but they were fine. So Phil calls and he says, you know, I'm going to send somebody to get you. And I thought, what? You know, we're in the middle of a disaster here, and you're going to send somebody to get me? I don't think so. And luckily, we had our, you know, casual clothes in the car, and we went and put on T-shirts and jeans. And I'll be honest with you, all I could think was, I'm going to have to do search and rescue. And I started praying that God would help me with that, because I didn't know how I would handle it. But God knew I couldn't handle it, so I told Mima that I was staying. And EOC, the people there on the ground, and I said, I'm staying, what can I do? And so they put me into doing shelters. So we set up two shelters. And then they were bringing the people to the gym, and the nursing home patients, and they're putting them around the wall, and they're throwing their mattresses on the floor. And all I could think was, you're going to put that patient who may have congestive heart failure or whatever else flat on a mattress on the floor with nothing. And so I got my team, and we went to Walmart, and we picked every blanket, every pillow, every pillowcase, every everything that we could find up. And we came back, and I knew it was all worth it, because the first little lady that I put a pillow under her head, she says, thank you, darling, that's so much better. So, you know, I just believe God puts you in places that you need to be. And I believe I was put there for a purpose, and I was just glad to be over there and see the incredible work that the community did pulling together in that situation and making it all work.
Now, Governor, when she said she wasn't coming home, what were you thinking?
We had a fairly energetic discussion about that, and she won again. But the terrifying time was when I asked her, where are y'all at? And she turned to security and said, where are we? And they said, we're approaching Louisville. And I was at MEMA headquarters watching one of the largest storms I had ever seen on radar bearing down on Louisville. So I was a little challenging to know that my wife and her team were right in the middle of that storm. And then she said, well, we'll come home. And I said, you've got to get to a shelter. Luckily, they were able to get downtown to the courthouse, and It was a little while before I was able to get back in touch with her. So that was an eventful day. I was there the next morning, and I think when I ran into the emergency management director there, he said, "I think your wife went to bed about 3 a.m., and she's still here serving breakfast this morning."
I think that's something that says a whole lot about how you approach things. So thank you very much for what you've done in your service. Got a couple of quick more questions to ask before we wrap up. When y'all first got elected and moved into the mansion, there was the need for some preservation work. Y'all actually had to find alternative housing. You mentioned the mansion earlier and the importance of having kids throughout the state understand the value of that home. Why was that so important to really focus on making sure we got the mansion renovated, preserved as something that was for the citizens of our state?
Well, the mansion.
In 30 seconds or less.
Okay, y'all witnessing the.
You saw that, honey. abuse. Quickly.
The mansion is just a very old building built in 1841, and it's the second oldest continuously occupied mansion in the United States. It's something we should be very, very proud of. But being as old as it is, you have to just keep up constant maintenance of it. The people that come there love seeing that mansion. It was just necessary. I wanted to leave it better than I found it. And so that was the whole reason that we worked really hard, and we were willing to get out for a year and make it happen. Is that short
stayed,
enough?
Yeah, we stayed about 6 months above Parlor Market in an apartment, and then about maybe 6 months in the basement.
Yeah.
So, I just reminded the contractors that if she's not happy, I'm not happy. So it took a pretty extensive. But I will, and I brought this for you, Scott, but this will be on sale. This is a book. The first book's been written about the governor's mansion. The wonderful paintings in it are by Bill Wilson, our artist in residence. The foreword's by the first lady. I wrote the reflections, so you'll be able to go inside the governor's mansion and this wonderful art and see it. And as I said, you can go on Amazon right now and pre-order the book. All the funds from the sale of the book will go to the mansion fund to help continue to maintain that beautiful old home.
Well, thank you. Well, listen, I get to control the time just a little bit, so I want to ask one more question.
All right, one more.
But I want to ask.
We're only thing standing between them and catfish, aren't we? Or chicken?
Right. That's right.
Thinking back, what do you think that you're going to miss the most about your life in public service when January comes?
The team. The people that we live with, our security, the team that works so hard. And I can tell you, I'm not being critical of anybody at all, but I believe I've got the best team any governor's ever had. And so a lot of young people, and I go to the office every day, and I see them every morning we wake up. They're security. They're part of our family. So that day when we get up and we won't see the team, and we won't be able to ask them how they're doing, how their family's doing. It won't be able to. That's going to be a difficult time. If you've ever had someone you really, really care about and you had to leave them, and we hope we'll stay in touch, but you know how that goes. So, yeah, leaving our family.
We'll be empty nesters one more time.
It'll be tough. Yeah, that's. I'll miss them dearly.
And surely there's nothing you're going to miss, right?
Oh, yeah, the lights that shine in the middle of the night from downtown Jackson. I won't miss that at all.
Well, see, I figured he would say it was all those texts I send him all the time.
They normally start about 6:30 in the morning, so yours are not, but about 6:30, I won't miss those, particularly if I see it's MEMA or Department of Public Safety at 6:30 in the morning. It's time to go to work. So I won't miss the early morning and late evening texts.
Well, before we go, I want to talk about one final thing. Deborah, you've spent a lot of time working with the Center for Medically Fragile Children. I understand that's moving along, and if I'm correct, there's a groundbreaking coming up very soon. Can you give us a quick update on where we are with that center?
Well, we are planning, hopefully December 10th we're going to do a groundbreaking for that center. It's going to be, I was hoping a 30 bed, but we're going to start with 20 bed facility. It's Mississippi I've just forgotten what it's called, Medically Fragile Children Center. And this is going to be for the kids at APSA. We have four that live in Batson. It will become their forever home. It'll be for a transitional care facility so that children that are able to move out of acute care can transition through this facility before they go home, and to prevent that from ever happening again. And I just think it's going to be a great thing for the state of Mississippi. Right now, these parents have to send their children to other states, and that's got to be hard. So we're excited about starting this. UMMC will own and operate the building, and we're making it a home-like facility for these kids.
Well, on behalf of all the great work that you've done, not only on that project, but for the state of Mississippi, we'd like to make a donation to the center your honor.
Thank you.
And we really appreciate it. Ladies and
gentlemen,
would y'all join me in one more time thanking Governor Phil Bryant, First Lady Deborah Bryant, for what they have meant to Mississippi.
This podcast is a production of the Mississippi Economic Council, the voice of Mississippi business since 1949. The Mississippi Economic Council is a public policy agency dealing with a variety of issues facing Mississippi's business economy. MEC is a not-for-profit member organization made up of more than 11,000 business leaders from across the state. Our mission is to move Mississippi forward through advocacy, research, resources, and leadership. We are the Mississippi Economic Council, Mississippi's Chamber of Commerce.